Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So we're going to start out with crowdsourced information from Switzerland, and then we have a couple of other emails I'll read later in the program. This from Sybil, who has often sent email to us from Switzerland on various questions. And I feel I may have touched a nerve when I responded to John in Switzerland. And I'm going to read Sybil's response to my reply, which was to suggest that they go to the Institute for Functional Medicine and see if there were any affiliates in Switzerland. But she replies, "For John in Switzerland, Switzerland is the epicenter of functional medicine, but other terms than functional medicine are used. Here are just some of the addresses near Zurich and Aargau." I'm not going to read that list, but I will count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and that's just in the immediate area of where John in Switzerland is in Switzerland. So, John, I will be sending that off to you. I'll forward her email de-identified, I think, just to let people know that, as just to quote Sybil, Switzerland is, I won't say the, honey, I'm going to give you an epicenter, however, of functional medicine. So let's go to our first article. And this is something where I'm going to make a call to political action. First of all, I want you to think about jobs, wages, and affordability, because we are all facing those issues in this country. And you can't find a job, or your health care is unaffordable. Well, you may not understand that we are basically back in the Gilded Age, and that large vertical monopolies and effectively cartels are driving up the cost of healthcare to the point where employers can't afford to hire people. Every time a company hires a worker, their benefits can cost them up to $30,000 per family per year for premiums and care. And most of that money does not go where it should. It goes to massive, vertically integrated insurance companies that can write their own ticket, because they essentially own the market and own the system. We need to do something about that. Representatives Holly and Elizabeth Warren have introduced Josh Hawley and Elizabeth Warren have introduced the Break Up Big Medicine Act. And this is a bipartisan bill that's modeled on the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act. I'm encouraging you to listen to a little bit of discussion about what's going on and what this act would do about it. At its core, the legislation prevents common ownership of a medical provider organization. Let's take Palo Alto Medical Foundation for an example. And one or more of the following: an insurance company, a pharmacy benefit manager, or a prescription drug or medical device wholesaler. The bill requires individuals who currently own, operate, or control both types of entities to divest from one category, either the provider organization or the insurer, PBM, or wholesaler, within 1 year of the bill's enactment. Now, I do not mean to imply that Palo Alto Medical Foundation is on the chopping blocks here. I know nothing about their corporate structure beyond the fact that they're a hospital and doctor organization, which I think would still be permitted under this. But what has happened all over the country in the last 5 years, I would say, is massive, massive venture capital moving into this idea of owning the healthcare system. So they're calling this act Glass-Steagall for Health. Let's go back. What was Glass-Steagall? Well, it was enacted in 1933 because Congress and Roosevelt believed it was imperative to break up the risky entanglement of commercial and investment banking that led to the 1929 stock market crash that led to the Great Depression. Basically, I want you to imagine that both your savings and your checking accounts are in a fund that became venture capital funding for the banks to make investments in AI. And how comfortable would you be about your money sitting as in a risky investment? Well, that's exactly what was allowed. And the banks wanted to make money, and they used that money to purchase stocks, which turned out to crash. And, well, the whole thing led to a massive depression. So Glass-Steagall separated banks from speculative securities operations. It established the FDIC to protect depositors and insure against bank failures, and served as a regulatory firewall that protected the savings of Americans. Well, let's move to healthcare. In recent years, health insurers have morphed into Wall Street-controlled bank-like institutions that bear very little resemblance to the nonprofit organizations that most health insurers were just a few years ago. In fact, many of the country's biggest health insurers are essentially now financial institutions that also just happen to own a health insurance company. But they're not just covering or not covering our health care costs. They're amassing profits across an amazing set of subsidiaries that have mutated these health insurers into monopolistic corporations similar to the trusts that Franklin Roosevelt's cousin Teddy ordered broken up to, in the 1920s when he was president. So let's give you some examples. United Healthcare Group, owners of United Healthcare, an insurer, also owns Optum Bank, which has more health savings account assets under management than any other financial institution in the country, Optum Ventures, Change Healthcare, pharmacy benefit managers, specialty pharmacies, and over 2,000 medical provider organizations owns. Now, that's what we call conflict of interest, and it's a great way to game the system. CVS operates both insurance products through Aetna and pharmacy benefit managers through Caremark, and owns a major pharmacy retail chain that shapes prescription pricing and competition, and has made multiple forays into setting up actual healthcare centers within their pharmacies. That has failed to launch on several occasions, but they obviously would love to own some healthcare too. Cigna has been bringing in far more revenue from the pharmacy supply chain since it bought Express Scripts in 2018 than from its many health plans, because there's money in pharmacies. There's money in pharmacy as a retail business. Elevance, which operates Blue Cross plans in 14 states, also owns a pharmacy benefit manager, a clinical operations, and a financial institution with millions in HSA under management. So the joint ownership of these companies, the PBMs, the medical provider organizations, and the pharmacies, allows the parent's company to game a regulation. It's like one of those tax loopholes. This is called the medical loss ratio. The 2014 Affordable Care Act required that insurance have medical loss ratios of at least 80% to 85%. And that was defined as meaning they spent 80% to 85% of premium dollars on, in fact, medical care. Well, when insurance companies own a pharmacy benefit manager, a provider group, a pharmacy, they can count the premium dollars that they spend to those entities as medical care for purposes of the MLR, when in reality they are self-dealing, and they can inflate the amount they pay their affiliated providers so that they meet those MLR requirements, and thus avoid sending rebates to their customers for noncompliance, which would be happening if they actually told the truth about what how they're spending money. So as a consequence, these large healthcare conglomerates have little incentive to contain costs. The self-dealing actually drives costs higher, while enabling them to convert more premium dollars to profits than Congress intended when it set up that MLR provision. In other words, they are gaming the system, which is what you expect big business to do. So, taken all together, big insurance profits from vertical integration by pooling their subsidiaries' reach and capital, investing in and paying themselves and influencing the cost and access of care for millions of Americans throughout the healthcare system has to stop. Breaking these companies up has to happen. Otherwise, we are looking at a similar collapse and catastrophe of Medicare, Medi-Cal, and the hospitals and the medical practices. So at that point, who's going to pick up the pieces? Well, I think that's a very good question, and I would rather not have to see it answered one way or another. And I'm sure you're with me on that. So please write to your representative if you're a citizen of the United States or if you vote, or if you're abroad and vote from abroad. Please write to them and support the Break Up Big Medicine Act. This is just insane. It is so broken. And I just shake my head every day when I see the behavior and the prices and the craziness that's out there. Well, moving on, people with blindness can read again after a retinal transplant. This came out last October. I have I'm reading Nature magazine here. I should mention that my lovely friend Guy, who gets Nature and Science via subscription, will periodically drop a box on me, and I will go through them and pull articles for the show. So we're going to be very sciencey this show, but I think I can make it entertainment and bring all of that esoterica down to firmly grounded on terra firma. So scientists have used a very teeny-weeny little eye implant. It is 2 millimeters by 2 millimeters and just 30 micrometers, so one-third of a millimeter thick. And they're inserting it beneath the retina to replace the light-sensitive cells that have been lost to the disease of macular degeneration. Macular degeneration is the biggest cause of blindness and in the United States. And this clinical trial, which was described in the October 22nd issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, involved 38 people with advanced macular degeneration whose retinas were severely damaged. 1 year later, 80% of the participants gained a clinically meaningful improvement. And what do they mean by clinically meaningful improvement? They mean two lines on the vision chart. So if you've looked at that Snellen chart ever, you know there's this massive, large E, and then there's three letters, and then below that there's, I don't remember how many, but the fonts get smaller and smaller. And if you go two levels of font, that's pretty good in terms of offering some increased function. Patients were able to read letters, read words, they could move around. And the thing about macular degeneration, take a moment, fix your eyes on something straight ahead of you, and then see what you see in the corners of your eyes, in your peripheral vision. You can see shapes, and you can see movement. In fact, the peripheral vision sees movement very well. It's to keep predators from sneaking up on you. But you can't read, and you can't make out details, and you couldn't recognize a face. You know, beige blur with blonde hair would be, you know, my physical description here. So it's really an impairment. And what's happened in macular degeneration is that you've lost the rods and the cones. You've lost the light sensors, but the retina and the nerve is still there. So what they're inserting in the back of the eye is essentially a light sensor, not unlike the light sensor in your digital camera. And in this case, that sensor is receiving information from some glasses that you're wearing and sending that information to the retina, to the optic nerve. And so it's using the nerve. Nerves are very hard to regrow. And essentially substituting this paired, I think it's Bluetooth eyeglass camera with the receiver on the back of the eye, which is essentially putting that image into the nerve, into the scale that it needs to be in. And it's just essentially bypassing the focusing on the eye and just sending the information, bouncing over the entire apparatus of the eye to get to the nerve. It also allows the users to zoom in and out on target objects. They can adjust brightness. It takes months of training to learn how to use this properly. But this study, which took place in Europe, showed substantial improvement. 26 out of 32 showed improvement. And I mentioned that was the two lines on the eye chart. And they had high levels of satisfaction. Now, this is just step one. This device has only 381 pixels. And we know, anyone who's lived through the last decade knows that miniaturization precedes apace very quickly once a device is proven and something with this level of marketability, because a lot of people have this problem, is likely to move fast in terms of improving the resolution and going from more than just a scientific study. Of course, this was done in Europe because they couldn't get certification to do the test in the United States. But that is, let's just say we're having some regulatory foot dragging at the moment. And that's due to everything you're aware of. I will not go into details. What I do want to do is go into details about heat waves and focus on how human bodies work. I had a scary experience in my office a couple of weeks ago when a patient remember those really hot days we had? Some people have air conditioning, but we're living on the coast. It's normally kind of foggy and cool. We complain when it gets into the 80s. I know many people within the sound of my voice are rolling their eyes. Such wimps. But because we are not acclimated to heat, people here suffer quite a bit from it. And in the case of my patient, she was on a medication called Lamictal, which is, a good medication for her illness, but it also interferes with the hypothalamus and its ability to adapt the temperature regulation. So normally when you get hot, you have an internal thermostat in the hypothalamus, which will start sweating and will start throwing more blood to the surface of your body to try to get rid of it. And she wasn't able to make those physiologic adaptations because that part of her brain was suppressed. And she went into a kind of heat exhaustion bordering, but not approaching heat stroke. I'll talk a little bit about heat stroke in a minute. But one of our problems is that the entities, the powers that be, and much of the science has looked at air temperature kind of exclusively as the measure of as a measure of heat. But because it's a system, right, there's the living body of the person and whatever their health issues and drugs are, and they are standing in a space that has a certain temperature. And the very first thing about these temperature warnings is they're triggered when the temperature gets above an unhealthy level. But really what we should be caring about is core temperature. So most, we should be paying more attention to physiology. So if the body gets up to about 39 degrees centigrade, and that's about the core body, not the surface of the body, then the risk of heat exhaustion goes up and people get nausea and they get dizzy and they may vomit, which is great because it dehydrates them further. Heat stroke is a different story altogether. Let me tell you what happens in heat stroke. There's an increase in gut permeability because there's a reduced delivery of oxygen by the blood. Why is that? Because all the blood is going to the surface of the body trying to vent heat off into the atmosphere. But it's not working well because the ambient temperature is 40. So those lipopolysaccharides in the gut from the dead bacteria leak across the bloodstream. The gut permeability drastically increases because the cells are suffocating, and so they shrink and they aren't doing their job of holding the barrier together. Once those LPS particles get into the bloodstream, they can trigger a massive cytokine storm that can cascade to blood clotting, organ failure, and death. So air temperature is important, but also radiation. So get this, someone in direct sunlight can be exposed to radiation that's 20 degrees centigrade, that's almost 30 degrees Fahrenheit, greater than shade temperatures. Air temperatures that are used to trigger health warnings are measured in the shade. So lesson number one is that you've got to be in the shade when it's hot, and being out in the sun with your skin uncovered and your head uncovered is very, very dangerous. It really increases your air temperature. And once you get above about 35 degrees centigrade, or call that about 95 degrees, 96 degrees Fahrenheit, the ability to lose heat through sweating is also affected. So you don't evaporate sweat well. And of course, if the humidity is high, that makes it even worse. And if you are obese or big, even with muscle, it doesn't even have to be with fat, you're going to have a harder time radiating that internal body heat. So you'll be at increased risk. Age, obviously. And then activity, even walking, just slow walking, doubles your internal heat production. And so, well, the physiology demands of hot weather are huge. And I don't think people really get this, so that's why I'm going into such detail. In hot weather, to lose that heat, and maintain the blood pressure and get the blood out to the skin, the heart needs to work harder. It has to pump more often. It has to pump with greater force. People with heart disease a heart attack can be triggered, or heart failure can be triggered. Furthermore, sending all that blood to the skin starves the kidneys of oxygen and fluid. And if you are also dehydrated in that hot weather, the dehydration can contribute to kidney fibrosis and chronic kidney disease. So people who are not staying hydrated and working are really, every time they do that, it's like giving their kidneys a bad blistering sunburn. If they work and they cause the kidneys to become dehydrated and trigger that fibrosis. And fibrosis is kind of like a little forest fire. Once it gets rolling, it doesn't necessarily stop. So some advice for thermal environmental control. First of all, wind is really key. And when it gets hot, sometimes the wind dies down. it takes a lot less electricity to move air than cool it. So at air temperatures below 30 degrees centigrade, a medium fan, a typical fan 1 meter away from a person, can drop the temperature of the skin by about 4 degrees. And that's really useful. If you also have fans, if you also have air conditioning, turn the air conditioning such that it's only activating at, say, 80 degrees, and then use fans to move the air, and you'll get a much more energy effective cooling. If you have cardiovascular disease, you just need to avoid activity during heat, stay in shade, and stay hydrated. Last thing you want to do is double the strain on your heart by walking around. If you have kidney disease, again, also imperative to stay hydrated. Everyone, long sleeve, loose clothing, preferably natural fabrics. If you can't afford natural fabrics, you want the clothing to be very thin. And so if you put one layer over it, you should be able to breathe through it without even knowing it's there. That's the kind of fabric you're looking for. So a quick one from Canon in Santa Cruz regarding strontium. Just heard you mention the problem with strontium, dense bones but not necessarily strong. Does that apply to oral supplementation of low-dose strontium? I was prescribed this by an oncological nutritionist while I was on Arimidex following treatment of breast cancer. I'm no longer on Arimidex and have discontinued the strontium. And she gives the dose and such. But Canon, yes, it does apply to that. And so your bone density test will have been improved, but it will not affect your fracture risk. So this is one of the problems that we deal with when we think we're doing something and it turns out we're only basically, well, it's sort of like cheating on a test, right? You get the grade, looks good, it fixes your GPA, but you actually don't take any of the knowledge home with you, which was, in fact, the purpose of the enterprise in the first place. So I think we want to monitor serial DEXA scans now that you're off the strontium. And what you're looking for, and I suggest you do also, is talk to your doctor about getting the telopeptide test, which is one that helps us understand whether you are continuing to lose bone from where you are. But essentially, by taking the strontium, you have set a new baseline for the test. So now if it shrinks from there, that's bone loss. And these blood and urine tests for the telopeptide are more sensitive to bone loss if a person is doing their stuff, exercising, taking calcium and vitamin D and vitamin K. They should be in more or less neutral territory after the first year off of the Arimidex. And if you are losing rapidly, though, that telopeptide will be high. But you won't necessarily see that on a DEXA until you've lost a lot of bones. So important there. And of course, depends on what else you're taking, bisphosphonates, etc. So let's see. This one from Randa in Aptos. Hi, I'm a healthy 77-year-old woman. Don't take any medication. All my blood tests show normal in every range. But a few weeks ago, my annual test showed platelets were low. My doctor wants me to take a 4-day course of high dexamethasone. This person I had told briefly last week to not do that, but I didn't go into any detail. I'm going to go into just a little bit of detail with platelets and say that platelets of 40 are adequate to take care of run-of-the-mill clotting. And so to jump immediately to steroids is probably not indicated. The other thing to do is to make sure that the blood is citrated before the platelet count and repeat it and see again where it's going. There are lots of things that can lower platelets, And there's a couple of autoimmune diseases that can do that, and also a precancerous condition. So there's a lot to look at there. I think you were seeing a doctor, don't know, I think it was just your primary. I really do think that at the minimum, seeing a hematologist would be a really excellent idea. Okay, let's talk fiber. There are a lot of fibers out there, so we can call this section fiber and FODMAPs, because FODMAPs are fermentable oligosaccharides. And so the important thing to understand about that is that those are types of fiber that good bacteria can ferment, and even bad bacteria can ferment them. But in doing that, it generates gas. So if people are having a lot of gas and a lot of cramping or irritable bowel syndrome, they're often placed on a low FODMAP diet. And a lot of really healthy vegetables are things that you should be eating are on that low on that high FODMAP list that you're told to avoid. So I always tell people, you know, go after fixing and rebalancing your microbiome. Don't just stay on the FODMAP diet forever. But let's talk about why do we want fiber? We want fiber because, of course, it holds fluid in the gut. It's anti-inflammatory. It helps with detoxification. And some fibers support a healthy microbiome. They are called prebiotics. So we're going to talk about some of the brand names a little bit. Wheat dextrin is one that is in the Benefiber that we were buying at Costco, I think, but they stopped having it, so now we get it online. But it's a starch, and it's a byproduct of processes that actually extract gluten from wheat. So it's a wheat fiber. It can be used daily. It is fermentable, so it does help with the probiotics. And it's technically gluten-free, but it wouldn't be recommended for people with celiac disease. Then there's guar gum and guar fiber. Guar gum and guar fiber are coming from a bean of the guar plant. One brand name is Sun Fiber, and that's guar fiber. Guar fiber makes short-chain fatty acids in the gut when it's fermented, but it ferments very slowly. So for people who are on a low FODMAP diet, this is the choice for you. And you would be able to use guar fiber. Sun Fiber and a company called Regular Girl also make it. So this might be the good soluble fiber for and still feed the microbiome. And I'm happy to learn that because it's kind of a dilemma. My favorite fiber is inulin, and this is found in chicory root and onions. It's generally added to processed foods as a fiber, but just because it's put in doesn't mean it's bad. The doses of inulin have to be watched because it is going to be fermented. It can definitely cause gas, but it's very healthy for the microbiome, particularly for the bifidobacterium, and it makes a lot of short-chain fatty acids. Those short-chain fatty acids, by the way, don't just feed the gut. That's why what I learned about 20 years ago, and that's why I thought they were good. But it turns out they're actually potent anti-inflammatory actors, and that some of them go up to the brain and actually have beneficial and calming effects in the brain. So, you know, who knew? So citricelle is methyl cellulose. This is made from wood pulp. And it's soluble but non-fermentable. So it doesn't really, it's just a space holder, and it doesn't cause glass and bloating. So it's, but it also doesn't contribute to the health of the microbiome. Psyllium is important to talk about because that is what they have in Metamucil, the husk of the psyllium seed. This comes from the Plantago ovata plant. And it's a non-fermentable fiber, soluble and viscous. It absorbs about 10 times its weight in water, and it forms a gel-like coating on the intestinal wall, which facilitates passage of stool. This is particularly good for older people who have low motility, or people who are on anticholinergic agents, or people who use a lot of cannabis will often find that this is the best thing for their constipation. However, the problem with psyllium is that recently there have been reports of high levels of lead, and in fact there is a class action suit against the makers of the orange powder forms of Metamucil, because the company failed to disclose that the products contain potentially dangerous levels of lead, and presumably there's proof that they knew that. So it should make us all kind of take a deep breath and say, gosh, sometimes the things you do to make yourself healthier actually bypass and backfire and make you less so. In the long run, though, you know, eating food, lots of vegetables, exercising, getting adequate fluids, those are good bets. You know, yeah, someone may have put arsenic in your water, but it's still potentially the healthiest beverage. And of course, there are ways to filter it. Get your water tested if you're on a well. That's always a good idea. If you're drinking water from a city water facility, it is tested, and I'm willing to believe that they are telling the truth about their test results. So let's see. We have another email here. This is from Judy in Alabama. Dear Dr. Don, I'm a 78-year-old female, 5'8", 150 pounds, with varicose veins. There's a family history of varicose veins. I walk about 2 miles a day. The veins in both upper thighs are very enlarged, and the enlarged veins go over my knees. For some reason, there are no enlarged veins below the knee, but I have purple ankles. I've worn thigh-high support hose daily for over 40 years. I had a VNUS procedure on the left leg 20 years ago, but now that same leg has another enlarged vein. I have been content to keep wearing support hose, but in recent years, my feet swell during the summer. In the winter, I have the opposite problem of finding it hard to get on my feet, hard to get my feet and lower legs warm. That has nothing to do with the veins, Judy, and that's a common problem as we age. Doctor keeps an eye on my kidney. I'm good there. Last summer, I additionally had self-diagnosed blood clots in those superficial veins several times. I had one that was diagnosed by a doctor 30 years ago, so I'm pretty sure of my self-diagnoses. I treated the blood clots with leg elevation and warm compresses several times a day. I want to emphasize to the listening audience that superficial blood clots do not end up in the lungs. It's the deep blood clots that end up in the lungs. But the fact that Judy is getting these has me concerned that she might be procoagulant, that there might be a problem with too many platelets, like the previous email from the lady who didn't have enough platelets. There's definitely a Goldilocks zone for platelets, and too many can be a problem as well. There are also other factors like inflammation and hormonal factors that could cause an increased tendency to blood clotting. I really don't know enough to advise Judy on this, except to say that it's really not normal to get superficial clots in your varicose veins, and so that would make me want to check and see if this person had pro-blood clotting factors in their system. That we have a lovely word for that. We call it thrombophilia, which, I don't know, it sounds much better than it is. So really what Judy is wondering is, should she get another brain surgery? She has several questions. Would higher compression support hose help? And the answer is probably not. Does external damage to a vein cause the internal blood clot? Veins are actually pretty sturdy things. They're pretty darn sturdy. And so it's unlikely that, like, kneeling on a vein would cause any problems. Floor exercises and gardenings, you're not that heavy. And so if you were, you know, walking, doing some sort of one of those devotional situations where people like walk on their knees for miles, yeah, maybe you could get into trouble. But for just ordinary stuff, we don't see it, even when the vein goes right across the kneecap. If I go see a vein surgeon, even though I would decline surgery, am I foolish to decline surgery? Is it necessary? Well, you get to decide if it's necessary, Judy. It's not medically necessary, but the veins can be uncomfortable. They can also, of course, affect your satisfaction with your body. I'll leave that to you. One thing to look into would be a superficial venous ligation. So basically what they do there is they ligate the superficial trunk at the hip, and that can be done under local anesthesia, and that will force the body to send the blood, to shunt the blood into the deeper structures, which probably have more capacity to carry that blood out. So, yeah, I think that exploring the surgery, you had a procedure 20 years ago, the technology has improved, and there is probably more out there for you. So please do consider getting to a vascular surgeon and exploring the less invasive outcomes that won't require general anesthetic. We can do exercise snacks. That'll be a useful one, not too sciencey. Turns out a lot of what we said about exercise physiology is actually maybe bunk. Maybe we don't need to be doing as much as we say. Maybe there's the fact that so many people now have wearables, and a lot of them are hooked into plans, or they have a health plan that's tracking their exercise. A lot of studies, lots and lots of data over the last decade. So the existing guidelines say 150 to 300 minutes of moderate physical exercise, or 150 to 150 minutes of vigorous exercise. Maybe you don't need that much. That is actually a big commitment, and I think a small commitment might be easier for people to make. Turns out that small snacks of exercise can make a big difference. Everyday movements like running to catch the bus or climbing up and down stairs. These are called vigorous intermittent lifestyle physical activity, VILPA. I like that. It sounds like a good girl's name, VILPA. But anyway, vigorous intermittent activity. Actually, they analyzed data from 25,000 people who did not exercise but were wearing a wearable, and so their physical activity. What they found is that those who engaged in three daily VILPA bouts of just a couple of minutes showed 1 to 2 minutes each, showed a 38 to 40% reduction in all-cause mortality over the study period. That's huge. And that's from climbing a minute? That's like one or two flights of stairs. That's enough. If you do that at work, just get off one or two floors early if you're in a big building. If you're in, I always take the stairs when I'm at the hospital because it's a free little exercise session, but I had no idea how much good I was doing themselves. So just an exercise snack, adding up to as little as 5 minutes a day, and longer bouts of moderate activity. So if you don't like climbing stairs or walking fast or running to catch the bus, then you just walk faster and do it for a little longer. You just walk it where you're comfortable and do it a little longer. You're in the moderate activity then. What that means is activity that raises your heartbeat just about over 100. So it raises your heartbeat, but it doesn't have to be up to the quote-unquote exercise level. The biggest bang for the buck for coronary heart disease risk actually occurs at the lower end of the exercise spectrum. So if you do that 150 to 300 minutes of moderate physical activity, you lowered your risk by 20 to 21% all-risk mortality. But if you did 20 to 70 minutes of moderate activity a week, most people probably do that, it itself resulted in 9% lower. But if people who exercise 600 minutes a week, they went from 20 to 30, but going beyond that didn't actually give you any increased benefits. So it flattens out quite quickly. And it also depends on exactly how inactive you are at baseline. So a moderate effort, 15 minutes a week, is enough to drop the mortality risk by 18%. So this was a study in older women who were taking 4,400 steps a day, and they got most of the benefits with lower mortality risk. You kept getting more benefits up to about 7,500 steps, 7,500. After that, there weren't really that much. It was diminishing returns, and you didn't see the kind of mortality drop that you would ordinarily expect. So exercise snacks, just setting an alarm. One more thing I want to talk about is time spent sitting. You've probably heard the phrase, sitting is the new smoking. Just getting up and walking every couple of hours even, and just walking to the end of the hall and walking back, or going downstairs if you're working at home, going downstairs or going outside and walking around the house once and going back in. If you're in an apartment, it's probably got multiple stairways. Taking just a short break every couple of hours drastically reduced the risks associated with being sedentary. Among those, I might add, little blood clots. So getting up, moving, not so much, not too much, just some, just frequently, makes a huge difference. And I know you can do that. And I know that you have time. It's just a matter of shifting what you do in those spaces when you go online or check your text messages. Get up and stand up and walk around and then check them and then go back to work. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. You can do it. I know you can. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.